The Bleacher Report app is your destination for sports. Right now, the NBA is heating up, March Madness is here, and MLB is almost back. Every day there's a new headline, a new highlight, a new moment you've got to see for yourself. That's why I stay locked in with the Bleacher Report app. For me, it's about staying connected to my sports. I can follow the teams I care about, get real-time scores, breaking news, and highlights all in one place. Download the Bleacher Report app today so you never miss a moment.
Hello, listeners of The Tower. All season's greetings, and I hope you're revving up for a fun holiday season with those you love. And I will finish up this year with a filmmaker I deeply love, my personal friend, the indie horror filmmaker icon and actress, Toby Poser. Walk into The Tower with us as we discuss Toby's Tower film, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. I shamefully had never seen this film before my discussion with Toby, and speaking to this insightful, soulful, beautiful human, Toby Poser, about this film was so thrilling. It's truly one of the most thoughtful episodes I've recorded to date, and it's such a beautiful deconstruction of so many beautiful techniques used in this film and how they've inspired Toby's filmmaking today. I'm so pleased to offer you this episode this time of year, or any time of year. And feel free to join us on Patreon. $1 a month gets you ad-free episodes. But either way, feel free to listen to this episode wherever you get your podcasts, where you're listening right now. Thank you so much for joining us, and welcome to my discussion with Toby Poser and her Tower film, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. Hi, welcome back to The Tower. Today, my guest is Toby Poser, actress, writer, director, filmmaker, an all-around wonderful human being. Hi, Toby.
Hi, Emily. I love talking to you, whether it's in a car, a cinema, or on Zoom. So thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining me, especially during this busy time for you. First of all, if listeners don't know who Toby is, she was an actress on the TV show Guiding Light for many years, but most horror fans know you as a filmmaker with your family. You've created so many brilliant films in the past few years. The Deeper You Dig, Hellbender, Where the Devil Roams. And then right now you're on tour with your current film, Mother of Flies. So congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Did I miss anything about you? There's so much that you do.
No, that sounds great. You might just want to add that I'm a fan of yours as well.
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you so much. Well, I'm so excited for people to see your current film, Mother of Flies. It's just breathtaking. And it actually speaks to the Tower film that you chose for today, because I feel like your films and the films that you're interested in, they always go a bit deeper than schlock and just scare for scare's sake. What drew you into kind of creating horror films initially?
It's funny because we made 4 or 5 dramas before we started making horror films. But the first one, which was back in 2010, our intention was actually to make a very, very dark, bloody ghost story. It was a Western, essentially. And we had started shooting it, but we had contemporized it. And we just were having so much fun with the girls. They were 6 and 11 at the time. We were living in an RV, traveling around the country. And we just weren't ready to go to the dark side. And we weren't ready to kill the kids, as it were. And so it took us a while to kind of earn our readiness, I guess. But we've always been drawn to dark stories. And so finally, we just, once we were in, you couldn't get rid of us. We just loved it. It just felt, I always say, it kind of felt like falling in love.
How so?
you know how you find the right person? We found the right genre. We felt like we were still making dramas, but they had so much more texture. It allowed us freedom. We weren't discovering on our own making dramas. But once we started making horror films, it just kind of cracked us open creatively. I mean, you can do anything within the genre and it still excites us tremendously.
No, totally. And am I right in thinking the first horror film that you guys did is The Deeper You Dig?
Yeah, John and Zelda and Lulu, I just helped shoot it, made an hour-long kind of visual poem called The Hatred, and I saw that and I thought, well, man, I want in on this too. So The Deeper You Dig was really my first foray into the genre, yes.
I love that film so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, so great to have you, and so great to talk about your Tower film today, which actually surprised me. You are such a cinematic encyclopedia. Like, you and I have talked about black and white films, silent films, just in long car rides together. We've talked about kind of everything under the sun. And so when I asked you to come on the podcast, I was trying to guess what you would pick, and this totally caught me off guard. So just if you don't mind telling the listeners, what film did you choose?
Sure. I picked Anna Lily Amanpour's 2014 film, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night.
So cool. Shamefully, I had never seen this film before watching it to talk to you.
And I guess I'm curious what you thought of it.
I loved it. I thought it was different than I was expecting, actually, because I feel like people, you know, it's called the first vampire Western, is how I've heard it described. And it honestly, I loved it. I love the characters. I love the world that Anna Lily creates in this. It's very much like a graphic novel, like Sin City. But it felt less like a Western to me and more like a black and white version of Rebel Without a Cause. Or,
I see that, sure.
You know, especially with that opening shot of our beautiful male lead just in that white t-shirt picking up a cat. I mean, that's a gorgeous man with a cat. Like, I love a guy with a cat. So yeah, I was like prepared for a Western, and I feel like what I got was a really beautiful story of two lost people finding each other.
I love that about it too. I do. I mean, I guess I picked this one because when, you know, the name of your podcast, you know, I mean, and the iconography of the tower card, there are several films I really could have picked in terms of a dramatic upheaval for me as a filmmaker. Maybe I'll just jump in and say there's a segue of two transitions between three scenes in this film that has stuck with me so beautifully that it really did feel kind of like an upheaval, a breakthrough of sorts. And I'll tell you what those scenes are.
How would you describe the plot of this film?
Oh, sure, yeah. I think this is a film about a vampire and a human finding each other in Bad City. Mm-hmm. And that's it in the simplest terms. But really what's neat about this film, I think, is that it's like a style and subgenre Ferris wheel. You know, it's sort of like, if you just spin it, there are so many different spokes of style in this film. It's essentially a black and white vampire anti-heroine spaghetti Western neo-noir love story, vigilante tale told in Farsi. So there's so many things going on. But essentially, it's about this place called Bad City. All the characters speak Farsi. It's black and white. It looks like a graphic novel or comic book, like you said. And this human, Arash, is taking care of his heroin addicted father. He meets a vampire who we don't even see right away in the film. And she wears a chador. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. Mm. You know, black robes or a veil over her normal clothing. So she looks like she's wearing the proprietary wear that, you know, of like a hijab or, you know, the big robes. Mm-hmm. And you don't expect a vampire to look like that.
Yeah. No, that's a great way to describe it, because it is really, you know, it's funny to use this word, but a mixtape, and the soundtrack is wonderful, so using the word mixtape is quite appropriate, I guess. But it's a mixtape of all of these different styles and elements that I've never seen brought together. And you're exactly right in calling her a vigilante, because she has this kind of almost Batman quality to her. Like roaming the streets of Gotham, avenging for the good of the city. So, I love that. Well, I'd love to dive in. What are your three scenes that you just mentioned?
Oh my gosh. So this is why I'm talking about this film today, because these scenes had such an impact upon me more than even the film itself. I just love this part. So she and the vampire, the vampire, meaning the girl, mm-hmm. and Arash, our male protagonist, meet. He's dressed as Dracula. So it's pretty funny, you know, and he's high on ecstasy and he meets the vampire, the girl on the street, and he says, "I am Dracula." And she doesn't say a word. And he hugs her. I mean, we've already come to learn this is a very, very dangerous woman. Mm-hmm. She's a vampire. And they had this standoff on the sidewalk that looks like a standoff out of a Western to me, mm-hmm. you know, and about 20 feet away, true vampire facing fake vampire. And he at one point hugs her, and you don't know what you're going to expect. He says, "You're cold." And he hugs her and he wraps her in his cape. And you can see how she feels. That this actress is, Sheila Vand, is so incredible. Mm. Without saying a word, she's so expressive. And you can see how good it feels, and how strange, almost as if she wants him to actually see her vampire to vampire. Mm. And then they're back at her apartment. I call it her lair, because this is where you see her in her normal habitat, you know, without the veils. And she's got pop iconography on the walls, and she's listening to cool music, and she's dancing, and she's performative in this space. So we already know that this is where she gets into character. And so she's there with this boy, this man, and they just have a very seductive scene, and he approaches her neck, beautiful long neck from behind, almost as if he were a vampire. Mm. And then she turns around and kind of smells him. You think, oh, is she going to bite his neck? But instead she just kind of falls and her head hits his chest, and it's almost like she's listening to his heart. And that, so the next transition goes right into where Arash, the man, is at the kitchen table with his father, Hussein. And Arash is kind of just poking two perfectly sunny side up eggs. And he's not breaking the yolk. He's just kind of like pushing them, you know, with a fork and not breaking. And he's got a little smile on his face. And he says he met a girl. And then it immediately goes, maybe, I guess there are three transitions here. It goes into Rockabilly, this trans looking character dancing with a balloon. And for me, the symbolism of having this beautiful night where two souls connect, going into the egg, not wanting to pierce the yolk, going into the balloon, floating, dancing on air, it just showed me how much you can show an audience as opposed to the classic show don't tell. I learned so much in those scenes. They impacted me incredibly, and I think about them all the time. It's just a beautiful way of saying everything.
I love how you just described that. It really is. It's like a feeling of floating and finding they find this thing that is in itself kind of like an egg yolk at first, because you're waiting for the yolk to break, right? We've already seen her viciously kill this drug-dealing pimp named Saeed, like, earlier with a Fu Manchu mustache, like, biting his finger off and then killing him. And so we learn the girl that walks home alone at night is not to be feared for, she's to be feared. And so I love the kind of switch of that idea, because immediately the title, you're just like, oh no, that poor girl. As a woman myself, I'm like, oh, I know that's a dangerous thing. But to flip that is so interesting. And so when she meets our lead, Arash, immediately we're afraid for him, because he's on ecstasy. He's not in his right mind, and he doesn't know that this girl is capable of just ending him. And so that the hug, I love that scene so much. And I love that he thinks he can't walk. And so she puts him on her skateboard because he's like, I can't walk. He's convinced, I guess, from just rolling on ecstasy, like, he can't walk anymore. And she's like, okay, and just puts him on her skateboard and, like, wheels him back. And it, that, honestly, that wheeling is kind of the beginning of this floating, delicate dance that you're talking about, because when they're back in her lair, her room with the best music and such cool posters on her wall, that scene, it's like 4 minutes, and they move so slowly, and they move almost like they're floating in water toward each other. And you're so right with, like, the egg not breaking and wanting to be delicate, and then the transition into dancing with balloons. There is a feeling of kind of lifting. It's so beautifully put. I'm so glad you pointed that out, Toby, because I felt like I was floating, and I look for moments like that in films, moments of transcendence, and how do you get there? Because it's kind of beyond words, right?
Yeah, it also really, it really, for me as a filmmaker, it shows me the power of tension and not breaking it. Like, how it would be less powerful if he actually broke the yolk. And we never have that satisfaction. So it's that tension is always there. And I find that really delicious. You know, I think that's something to remember. And that maybe that's why I'm always thinking about those scenes, that it's we never have the satisfaction of the bursting. It lingers. And we also never even see them kiss, but it's so intimate, you know. And when you're talking, and the rockabilly character dancing with the balloon is so neat too, because someone might say, well, why is that character even in it? Besides the fact that it's pretty irreverent to have a cross-dressing character in an Iranian environment, sounds pretty dangerous too. But for me, that character, and I know you know a lot about Greek theater, I'm always fascinated by characters I think of as a Greek chorus. This character doesn't say anything, but it kind of shows up. It's sort of witness throughout the film, and I love that as well.
So as far as this sequence, because I feel like this is the heart of this film for you, as far as, like, inspiration, has this sequence inspired sequences in your own films?
I definitely love, not necessarily this sequence other than what I just mentioned, the lesson of creating tension and keeping that tension, no matter how hard I might want to burst the tension. I really love black and white. I mean, and in our film, Where the Devil Roams, we eventually bleed all the color out of the film till it's black and white, like an old, you know, silent movie.
Yeah.
But this film to me, I'm also really, I love German expressionism. Mm-hmm. And so that's something I'm always thinking of. And to me, Emily, it goes back to my love of black box theater. You know, there's something yeah. about black and white, anything, a black and white film that reminds me of black and white, of the blacks of black box theater mm. and the minimalism and the use of imagination. I just love, like, I'm never going to, that hugely influences me in our film works and private moments that I like to use in our films. Go back to my love of black box theater and the intimacy and the minimal, liminal, you know, feeling you have in those dark spaces. And I find that in this one, I think they use anamorphic lenses. It has a really strange feeling in this movie that feels kind of claustrophobic, like Bad City is almost trapped in, you know, the bad smog rising up from all the dead bodies in the ditches. And how can you ever escape? I mean, you see scenes of desert roads. In the end, they drive along one. But for me, it's very claustrophobic. And I think we really enjoy similar vibes in our films.
No, absolutely. And I think what really impressed me about this film and what really impresses me about your work as a filmmaker is how, obviously, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night didn't have the biggest budget in the world. This was her debut, and it has created her well-deserved career. But, it's obvious this is an indie. And it's just amazing how much of a world she's able to paint using not a lot, you know? They filmed in a place called Taft, California. And little things that paint the world, like that ditch of bodies that you see at the very beginning, you're like, oh no, this is this town. That's kind of enough to be like, oh, I know what this is. And the smokestacks in the distance and the kind of looming danger and the over, like, bigger than life characters, they all just, you never doubt that Bad City is a place, you know? And I feel like she's so successful creating that with minimal things, if you think about it. And I think you guys are so good at doing that too. I feel like this film and a lot of your films operate outside of the realm of reality. You know, this film kind of feels to me more like a fairy tale in a lot of ways. And I think that ownership and ability to create such a clear world in this film, I see so clearly in your work. And it's just kind of a pleasure to, like, peek into your brain a little bit to be like, oh, that's what she loves. And to see what has influenced your films is just, it's just so fascinating.
Oh, thank you. I love the world that she creates. I mean, you know, you've got an environment, you've got drug dealers and pimps and oil pumps and pits of bodies. Mm. And it's just dusty. You feel really kind of grimy watching this film. I also, speaking of pumps, something I love, and sometimes I don't know whether these things, I don't want to assume that the director meant for this or not, but I'm always looking at symbolism in films that I just love. And sometimes for us, I feel like, oh, it's luck. You know, people thought this meant this, and, you know, and other times I really want people to see something. Maybe you feel that too. Mm. But there's a lot of surprise always in capturing or discovering what people capture and how in their interpretations of your film. And something I love about this one is the pump. You see the pumps. And for me, that's such a great parallel to fangs. You know, these pumps are sucking off the earth. Hmm. And while she is a vampire, she's sucking off of people's blood. And, you know, they're both taking things. They're both, using up resources. And I found that really interesting, pump versus fangs.
I didn't see that. And now I'm not going to be able to unsee that, I feel like, when I watch it again. Yeah, it's that's so true. It's kind of slurping up the energy, the life force of this place. That's so interesting. You know, and it's interesting that you make that parallel too, because she doesn't seem to be driven like a lot of vampires. She doesn't seem to be starving. This seems to be more like a mindful process, almost like a like drawing oil from the ground. This is a mechanical process. This is something she has to do. She almost feels indebted, or she has promised to do this during the course of her life. Even going as so far as to like scare the crap out of this little boy, in the middle of the film, to kind of even head off the next generation to try to not get him to turn that way too. So like the oil pumps, this seems like her job, you know?
Yeah, I agree. And except there's a strange, except like any kind of great film, then just when I'm thinking that, she does something that's not very nice. You know, with this scene when she's talking to the prostitute, and it's a really lovely scene where the prostitute Atti and the girl are talking, and the vampire has given Atti the jewels, you know, to help her. I think it shows the support women have for each other, even a vampire for a human. Mm. And then Atti, the prostitute, says to her, "Well, what do you do, or who are you?" And then she shows us, because it immediately goes to the vampire killing a homeless person. And I'm thinking, well, what did he ever do? You know, he's just homeless. And so I like that a scene like that makes me question her. And it helps when the vampire then says to Arash, you know, "I've done terrible things. You can never know all the horrible things I've done." And I'm happy for that, because there's nothing I love more than a character who challenges me to love them and hate them. You know, I love them and I don't like them in equal measure. And that for me is something I love in a film. It's something I strive for in our films. And she definitely is that. She's an anti-heroine all the way.
We meet her in this long shot as we're kind of creeping toward her in her bedroom. She's dancing to this really cool music. And you immediately are just like, who's this girl? She is so cool. And then we see her flying down the sidewalk, almost like a caped crusader, with her chador kind of waving behind her. I know. Yeah, she's like a bat. And I heard Anna Lily refer to it as almost like a stingray.
Nice.
Yeah. I was like, oh, that's such a good image. But she seems otherworldly. You're afraid for her, and then you see what she can do. And she, yeah, you're right. She's constantly challenging the audience. She is going through the motions of life, and it takes her meeting her own Dracula to kind of break that egg in herself of saying life is more complicated than just I need to avenge. Honestly, he is selling drugs. He is high when she meets him. If she's following her code, she should probably kill him, I would think. But yeah. But something gets in the way. And I think that's what's so beautiful about this film is she has a process. She has a ritual, and she has a vendetta. You know, maybe she's from a long line of vampires who are doing this, who are avenging this land, and yet the heart gets in the way. And I love seeing how conflicted and how imperfect she is.
Yes. Me too. She even has a kind of strange innocence, wouldn't you say? You know, and then you see her. I mean, she's just like, for me, she, even though the cat isn't a black cat that we see throughout the film, for me, the girl is like a black alley cat that you do not want to cross paths with. You know, she's just a powerful, menacing thing. And yet sometimes she seems so innocent. And I love that we don't know her history. Like, that is so powerful. Like, I don't need to know her history at all. I just need to know what I know, which is this is a woman who kills bad men and sometimes homeless people. That throws the glitch in that. And she's lonely. You know, vampires are lonely creatures. And another thing that I love about this as a love story is there's always going to be distance between a vampire and a human unless you turn the human, you know? So that distance is always going to be tragic. It's a space that has power, in the same way that I feel about a film like Let the Right One In, you know? It's tragic that a vampire cannot be a human, and a human can't know what a vampire has, you know, has gone through and what it needs to exist in for infinity. It's a really tragic figure.
I totally agree. And I think that what you just said points exactly to the beauty of the title, because the title initially strikes fear, at least into, you know, I'm a woman. I know a girl walks home alone at night. I know she is likely in danger. There are windows everywhere. There's darkness. She could be attacked. There are implications to that title. But what you're saying, it really beautifully turns the title, the idea of that title, on its head. And she is walking home alone at night because she is alone. And there is no one to walk home with her because she is indebted and she is eternal and no human can know what this is. And we don't see any other vampires. She's not part of like a posse, like Lost Boys or Interview with a Vampire. She is alone. And I think that it just makes the title even more beautiful, because once you really understand how alone she is, the title just rings just kind of melancholic and beautiful in such a sad way.
I agree. And so all the characters really are lonely in this movie. And I find aloneness on film incredibly romantic, you know, because I think we all experience it in our own ways. I mean, his father, Hussein, is so broken up about his wife. All he can do is get high. I think the cat is his wife, you know. Ati, you know, the sex worker won't talk to Hussein unless he's paying her. It's that despair and loneliness that really, I think, connects Arash and the vampire. They're both outsiders, and their lonely outsider status kind of puts them on the same level. And you kind of really hope that they'll escape together. Like, maybe they really needed each other to finally get out. And of course, in the end, it looks like they're going to, but it's complicated.
That final scene when they're in the car, it's so beautiful and it's so simple. The camera is just kind of between them. You can see that beautiful large cat in the background. It's like my favorite shot, I think, of the whole film. That cat is so big. I love that fat cat. He's so cute. But he's just kind of sitting between them. And I mean, as you know, as an actress, Toby, you put a baby or an animal on screen and everyone's going to watch them because they're not acting. Like, there's no filter on an animal or a baby. And so when you've got this cat between these two people who are just held in this moment of uncertainty, you know, for people who don't know, the girl, the vampire, has actually killed Arash's heroin-addicted father. And Arash learns this when they're about to run away together because he finds the cat in her home and she couldn't have the cat any other way. And so he knows that she has done something that she is likely responsible for his father's death. And so this final scene, we're between them in this kind of wide shot there. She's on the left of frame, he's on the right, the cat's in the middle. And you're just kind of drawn to watching this scene play out. And I wonder if she planned to do this. It plays out so beautifully because that cat is not acting. It's looking between them, almost as if it's held in this moment of, what the hell are they going to do? I don't know if you felt that watching it.
I did. And then it looks forward. You know, it looks like right yes. in the camera. It's like, what's going on? Let's look at them again. What's going on?
You know? I was like, this yeah. cat is the best actor in this movie. That's
it so is. And do you not love the scene too? Earlier in the movie when he's stolen these earrings mm-hmm. and he notices she doesn't have pierced ears and then he pierces her ear. Ugh. Again, how weirdly ironic is that he's piercing a vampire in any way when she's all, you know, we know she has fangs that can pierce him to fucking death. And here he is like piercing her ears. I found that so strange and kind of wonderful. It's so weird.
I honestly, that was like the most romantic scene for me, aside from the one that you've already mentioned, which I think just kind of floats above. That scene, though, affected me. It felt like first love in high school or something when you steal away. And I don't know if you had this, but I lived in kind of the backwoods of South Carolina for a little while after my parents divorced. And I remember being so bored at this kind of just in the middle of nowhere country high school. And I remember some of the girls used to, they would take a lighter and they would let it burn. So it got hot. And then they would hand the lighter over and like dare each other to press it into their skin. And it would leave this mark. And if you had this mark, you were like brave enough to do this thing. And I remember girls seeing if a guy would do it for them, like do it to their own skin to see if they liked them. It was so messed up. I don't know if I ever did it. I think I never got it hot enough to like do it on my skin. I mean, this is the dangers of boredom in the South. you get up to no good. But it was this like weird rite of passage where it's
branding, literally.
yeah, exactly. But this scene where he pierces her ears, it felt so teenagery. It felt so like, why on earth are you doing that? You can hear the adults just be like, why are you doing this? And of course it doesn't make sense because you're young and you don't know how to express yourself yet, but this feels like something. It feels like a pact, you know, it feels oddly magical. And him piercing her ears felt, I don't know, like some odd, beautiful, slightly painful covenant between them. Like her offering her earlobes, her skin to him and allowing him to slightly hurt her, for a vampire especially to do that, it's kind of the most vulnerable she could be in a way.
I know. I mean, it's just like to have someone pierce her, the ultimate piercer, you know, the pierce queen and the pain that she feels, you know, you see her fangs come out the first ear. It's just so, I love it so much. It was so clever. It's the kind of thing where I'm like, oh my God, I wish I thought of that. It was great. And how about, since you mentioned Saeed before, how about Saeed and his lair? I mean, that is like, he thinks he's the lion and this is his lion's lair. He's like preening, lifting weights, you know, getting his groove on. He's even doing like a mating dance and he's surrounded by all this animal imagery. Like he's the hunter, you know, when he's like, oh boy, little do you know, you're with the real predator here. He's so disgusting and very handsome. You know, it's like, oh my God, this character. I love that scene. And it's so nice that he gets what he just gave. You know, you've come from the girl watching him getting a blowjob from Ati in the car. Mm. And then I love it when, you know, the girl bites his finger and then puts lipstick on it, which had been foreshadowed when the girl is getting into character in her place, you know, putting on the lipstick and everything. It was like, oh, this is great foreshadowing. I love this. That is one of my favorite kills.
Oh, it's so satisfying. And yeah, when she when she goes to his apartment or his house, it's just, yeah, it's like leopard print and there's like a stuffed cheetah or something. Or is it a tiger? And he's got what I imagine are probably gold chains. And I love that he does drugs and immediately starts lifting weights almost for her, like showing her, like, see. And they look like 10-pound dumbbells. Like, they don't look very heavy. But he's, like, kind of doing a mating dance. The soundtrack for this film, too, I have to say, it makes so much sense that you were drawn to this film as well. Like, it makes more and more sense the more we talk about it, because music is such a huge part of your filmography, too. And you have, like, a band with your family, and you basically do all the music for your films, too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we do.
When did that start?
Well, John has always been in a band and playing a lot of music, and he and Lulu had a band when she was very little, and then he and Zelda had a band, and then maybe around 2012, I started to kind of sing, and we would make videos, and then probably around maybe 2019 or 20, it just became, we actually became the band Hellbender. Mm. And that preceded our film Hellbender, because then we just wanted to explore what is this, the concept of a Hellbender that we called our band. And that's kind of where the movie came out of that in some ways. So around 2019 or 20, probably 2020. And we just always have music in the house. So we're always just singing, and John's always writing. And it's something that we really enjoy. It's really kind of upped our creativity, because it's fun when it's in the music. Sometimes a song will inspire a scene in a film, or the other way around. Sometimes a scene will inspire a song. It just depends.
It's such a beautiful part of your filmmaking, and it's so complete and organic. You're just such a fully contained unit when you guys create together, because it's just top to tail, it's all you, and it's just so satisfying. Yeah, the soundtrack to this film just really registered with me, just kind of the hooking quality of all the music, and your band Hellbender, you guys just create such earworms. I find myself like listening to it on Spotify every now and then, because it just draws you in and it's so cinematic. Do you have like a favorite song or track that plays in this film?
In this one, I guess it's funny. We only have 5 actual songs from the band. John was much more reserved with the band. I mean, and I think that helps, because the songs we do have really seem perfect for the scenes. I guess it would be, let me see, Baron. Well, I like the song a lot. Murder. There's a song that says, "This love is murder." And I think that's, mm-hmm. That says a lot. I'm probably, I have to think of what other songs we have in there, but I'll just, yeah, that one's beautiful. And Baron is a beautiful song as well.
I'm obviously asking people to choose a very difficult thing, which is to say what film kind of burned down all of your preconceptions about films in the past and allowed you to see cinema in a different way. I mean, what would you say, if you had to kind of sum it up, what about this film specifically did that for you when you saw it?
I would say it's the strange love story of two people who don't make sense. You know, a vampire and a human is always just going to be difficult. But it's just, I love this love story. I really do. I mean, those are the scenes I mentioned, that those sequence of 3 or 4 scenes, just for me, I think about them all the time, and they're probably movies I love more, but those scenes had such an impact upon me, because they're just beautiful and strange, and they don't make sense. Like, it shouldn't happen, and that makes everything heightened, you know, and just the weirdness of a real vampire falling in love with a man who's dressed as a vampire and has no idea what danger he's in, I find incredibly sexy. And so it's really those few scenes just had such an impression upon me. And then just the general, like, if you think with the tower card as well, how you better have a solid foundation. I mean, you have the lightning going on and you know, the iconography and that image of the tower card. Mm. And, you know, a lightning strike is always a kind of awakening or shock. But you better have a strong foundation, like the tower, you know, things will crumble, but it kind of, for me, that card represents resistance, even within new skies. And so I like the foundation of this film as something kind of simple. I think a lot of people probably try to analyze it as a feminist story. I'm not sure that's her intention. And certainly you can't escape that when you have a story about a vigilante girl dressed in a chador killing bad men. You're going to have feminist conversations. Yeah. But, and they call the sex worker a hag, and why doesn't the prostitute want to have kids? You know, it's like there are issues there, obviously, women's issues that are there. But I don't think that was her purpose. For me, I love the simplicity of this love story. In like Bad City, and Are You Going to Get Out? It has just a classic, for me, that is kind of Western. It has a class and like classic, the stranger kind of riding into town. In this case, it's the stranger going to get out of town. That's what I love about this.
That is so well put. I think after hearing you say that, now I can kind of see the Western in it, actually, because you're exactly right. She's the lone rider on not a horse, but a skateboard. And he has that awesome car, obviously. That's so true. And I have to say, I love, using the tower card that is so kind of jarring for some people, but I honestly have to say I love your choice of film for this, because I think the iconography of the tower card could draw people to picking like a very large, bombastic, high stakes, high energy, plot beats are perfectly spaced out, just kind of run and gun movie. But this is such a quiet meditation of two lost souls finding each other. And it's just, it's told with very black and white and stark, beautiful, anamorphic cinematography, but it's a very tender story at the heart of this. And I love your taste. I love that this was the film that you chose. And I especially love that I got to see it for the first time.
Well, I'm so glad. That's so great to hear. You're so right. It is very, very tender. And I'm sure some people don't even, will even say it's not a horror film, because it's really scary. But you're right. It's so tender. Like that scene where Ati offers the vampire the plum and says, here, have one. It's sweet. Mm. And she kind of holds it in her hand. You know, she can't eat it. She just doesn't eat plums. And then later he offers her a hamburger. He's like, I've never known anyone who doesn't like a hamburger. And you feel so badly for her. So it is very sweet. And yet it's also dark and wicked. I really like this film a lot.
Yeah, no, me too. And no, you're exactly right. She can't eat the plum. She can't eat the hamburger. She can't bring herself to bite him. She is honestly in a bit of a stasis at the end of the film. She's in that kind of floating, I don't want to break the egg yolk state at the end. And they're kind of held in this moment before the rest of their lives of saying, are we doing this? this is a really lovely way to kind of close the discussion on A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. Where do you think they go? What do you think happens to them when they drive off?
It's a great question. Well, you know, there are, I think, twice in the movie, I think there are scenes that are what I think is her dream. I think she's dreaming and she pictures Arash in a dark tunnel with the light behind him.
Yeah.
I can't remember if he's standing there or walking towards, but for me, that is her dreaming of, well, should I turn him? Mm-hmm. You know, is he walking away from the light into the darkness toward me? And so I like to think that eventually he learns what she truly is and that she's going to turn him. That's what I hope for, because I'm his total vampire sucker. I love it.
I love that. I'm a vampire sucker. I think that's a good t-shirt.
What did you think, Emily? What happens?
Yeah, I think he knows exactly what she did. I think this is so sad to say, but I think he sees his father's death as almost a, I think he's made peace with it by that end scene. I think it,
yeah.
You know, I think his dad had a very painful life, and it was a kind of cruel kindness, maybe, to end him that way. I think Arash is, he is troubled by that, but I think he's made his decision of where to go. I don't see them as being, you know, I love the end of another vampire film that our two friends are in, Barbara Crampton and Larry Fessenden, Jacob's wife.
Yeah.
I love the final shot of that and the final scene of that film, because they are held in a kind of more dramatic version of this last scene, right? They're kind of husband and wife. She is a vampire. He's a preacher. He knows how to kill her. She knows how to kill him. And they are sat on, you know, together, kind of looking at each other, perfectly capable of ending each other, but agreeing not to. And I think we're in a quieter, more tender version of that in the final scene of A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, because he's able to accuse her and say, "You killed my father, prepared to die," kind of thing. And she is fully capable of ending him anytime. And yet they don't do that. And so I wonder if they go off and he is kind of her familiar for a while and like helps her. And I wonder what they would be like as vampires together.
Yeah, I don't know, but I think you're right that his father's death in a way was a strange gift. Mm. And it helps too that his father was not very nice right before he died. You know, he was, you know, he didn't do that. He was, I thought that was really cruel what he does to Ati.
Yeah. Honestly, you're exactly right. I think him injecting Ati with the heroin, I think that's the cruelest thing I see in the film.
With you, all the way.
Yeah. I think even with our vampire killing the pimp at the very beginning, that pales in comparison with him injecting her. And it's really interesting, just kind of in closing, the father having mourned his wife so much that he has gotten himself addicted and spiraling so that his life really doesn't have much meaning anymore aside from seeking pleasure. You know, it's interesting to think with Arash and the girl driving off into the sunset, if he is turned into a vampire, neither one of them ever have to die. And so maybe they can escape that the fate of the father in a way.
Yeah. And then there's that little boy too, right? Who dresses like a little old man, little ragamuffin boy.
Yeah.
Who kind of seems like he's already ancient. Yeah. It seems like Bad City is a good place to escape. And I like to think that it's a happy ending. They're driving away.
Yeah. I totally agree. I think they're cutting ties. She's cutting ties with her purpose in life, or what she thought was her purpose, and kind of laying down her the vengeance and choosing love.
Yeah.
Well, Toby, thank you so much for being on. I mostly just wanted to open this up to people I just respect so much in cinema and filmmakers and just dear friends, which you're all of those three. I've just been curious. And yeah, this is a bit of a selfish exercise, but this has been so much fun to like pick your brain about this. Thank you so much.
Oh, for me too. And when I get you in my claws in private, I'm going to ask you what your Tower movie is.
Yeah. I've been thinking about that a lot. Yeah, we'll talk. We'll talk.
Thank you so much, Emily.
Awesome. Thank you, Toby.
Hello, listeners of The Tower. Happy holidays, and the new year is approaching. I don't have another episode for you here in 2025, but my first episode in 2026 for the new year, I've invited Glass Eye Picks alum, the wonderful Jen Wexler, to deep dive into her Tower film, which was quite surprising to me. Jen Wexler is such an iconic horror director, horror producer, and so I assumed her film would be horror. That was not the case, not exactly. So join us in the new year for my first episode of The Tower with Jen Wexler and her Tower film, All That Jazz. The Tower is a Glass Eye Picks production. The show is created and hosted by me, Emily Bennett. The show is produced by Jordan Goss-Pouret. Technical advisor is Justin Brooks. Sound engineering by Mark Bush. Original music for The Tower was composed by Graham Resnick. Additional music provided by Epidemic Sound. Art by Steak Mountain. See you next time.
We all prefer things a certain way, like groceries. If you want groceries just how you like them, you gotta try Instacart. They have a new preference picker that lets you pick how ripe or unripe you want your bananas. Shoppers can see your preferences up front, helping guide their choices. Because when it comes to groceries, the details matter. Instacart. Get groceries just how you like.
The Bleacher Report app is your destination for sports. Right now, the NBA is heating up, March Madness is here, and MLB is almost back. Every day there's a new headline, a new highlight, a new moment you've got to see for yourself. That's why I stay locked in with the Bleacher Report app. For me, it's about staying connected to my sports. I can follow the teams I care about, get real-time scores, breaking news, and highlights all in one place. Download the Bleacher Report app today so you never miss a moment.